It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out. Sometimes being a person with PMS and/or menopause is hard. Every few weeks, there's the struggles of bloating, cravings, and an overall feeling of discomfort in our skin. But now, with Happy Mammoth's Hormone Harmony, it can be easier to manage symptoms. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. The beauty of adaptogens is that they help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony can help with so many hormone-related issues. Emily has been using it, and what she has enjoyed is how it supports hormonal balance and regulation, promotes healthy weight loss, can help curb cravings, and relieve mood swings. Feeling like myself again is mentioned over and over in Happy Mammoth's reviews, and there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today. This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
First, this is not an ad or sponsored in any way. This case came to my attention by accident. I don't recall what led me to search newspapers.com for articles featuring the term headless skeleton, but that was what I did.
Typical Tuesday.
In Washington and Oregon alone, there are over 200 results. One of those headless skeletons took me first on an early 1920s cross-country road trip before plunging me into a series of thefts, disappearances, and possible murders that were all a part of one family's trade. You need to plan a road trip. Let's say you're traveling, and this is just off the top of my head, from Annapolis, Maryland, to the Puget Sound, Seattle area of Washington. You'd Google the trip's beginning and endpoints, and gasp at the estimated 41-hour drive time. You'd pack your stuff, assemble a playlist, slip into your driving comfies, and pop on your sunnies. As you get into your vehicle and type both ends of your trip into maps, You give a satisfied nod and think nothing more of it. Confident in your route, your car, and the assured availability of fuel, food, and lodging.
What are your chosen car snacks on this road trip?
I like a donut. I like usually a fruit pie, like a Hostess fruit pie. Skittle.
Yeah.
And nuts.
I like corn nuts.
I'm a
corn nut gal, maybe some Starburst.
Make that car stinky like feet.
I used to do beef jerky, but I don't do that anymore.
It's rude to the others.
Yeah. If people don't like it.
Well, it's even when you do like it, if you're not eating it, it's not a smell I want to smell.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
My go-to treat is a Reese's Fast Break.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever heard anyone utter those words.
And that's like, it's the only time I have it, and I get it every road trip.
Interesting.
My little treat.
I didn't know that about you.
Little secret treat.
You hit the open road, slap it into auto drive, and kick back. The app will show you the way. Automobile travel was a little bit different 100 years ago. During research, I read about a road trip from Long Beach, California, to just outside of Cleveland, Ohio in 1920, which took almost 7 weeks.
That is a long trip.
This is a quote from a diary written during that trip.
This sucks.
Essentially.
Why? I don't Let think I like home. This trip. I won't be doing this again in a fortnight.
We went up a sandy mountain and through ravines on low mostly. About 50 miles bad road, all upgrade. We struck civilization just before dusk. We sure was glad to see someone. We went 100 miles and never saw a dwelling. Sand and more sand. We camped beside a well, all alone, near a store. And this is an entry detailing their arrival. It has rained all day. About 12 miles from Cleveland, the darn tire had another puncture. Just got out of the main part of Cleveland, and the front left tire went down. Before we got to Lorraine, the front left tire blew out. Dad said let it go, so we drove on it, and the left hind tire punctured, so we took it off and went on the rim. We got stuck in the mud in Chagrin Falls and walked a couple of blocks to Aunt Estella's at 10:30 p.m. Chagrin Falls is a perfectly ironic endpoint to their journey, as chagrin means disquietude or distress of mind caused by humiliation, disappointment, or failure.
Also, that's with a vehicle, which it wasn't that long before that it was covered wagons.
And wooden wheels.
Oh, my God.
One of the only reliable navigation tools drivers had back in the day was the Automobile Blue Book, which was published in a multi-volume series from 1901 to 1937-ish. This is a quote from the International Cartographic Association. The official Automobile Blue Books introduced commercialization to automobile touring and the business of road mapping. Automobile Blue Books encouraged and promoted automobile touring, and users were expected to patronize the businesses that advertised in the series. Although many route guides were marketed during the first decades of the century, the official Automobile Blue Book series was by far the most widely used and successful. It remained in publication for nearly 40 years and was one of only two guide series to cover the entire United States. Individual blue books in the series were often 800 pages long, detailing over 500 routes. The guide's written turn-by-turn directions had to be laid out once in each direction. The routes were the same, but the directions were reversed. According to the University of Notre Dame, in the 20s, the government sought to rationalize long-distance auto travel with the introduction of the U.S. highway system. By late 1926, travelers might have followed Route 66 from Los Angeles to Chicago. The 50s saw the development of the interstates, but in 1920, the amenities offered by modern highways were few and far between. The Pikes Peak Ocean-to-Ocean Highway is the shortest transcontinental highway in the United States. Roughly, it follows the 40th parallel. Starting at New York City, the highway runs westward in almost a straight line, except where the country makes that impossible. The course of the Pikes Peak Ocean-to-Ocean Highway is from New York through Philadelphia, Washington, Baltimore, Cumberland, Wheeling, Columbus, Dayton, Indianapolis, Springfield, Illinois, Hannibal, Missouri, St. Joseph, Belleville, Kansas, Colorado Springs, Glenwood Springs, Salt Lake City, and southwest to Los Angeles. In 1920, there were 8 million plus vehicle registrations in the United States. By 1929, there were 23 million. A horrifying statistic from that same decade that, quote, 60% of automobile fatalities nationwide were children under the age of 9.
I wonder why, because there were no car seats.
Accidents and also from kids getting hit. Kids playing in the street.
things.
Cars were a new thing to look out for.
Well, yeah, there was no speed limit. The road rules were geared toward horse and carriage travel, and early cars drove like crap. Some of the first autos had no way to steer other than ship-like rudders and tillers. These automobiles were piloted mostly by the untrained and unlicensed. I read about an 11-year-old boy who drove their family around Detroit during the post-World War I automobile boom.
Because they probably didn't even invent licenses yet, right?
That's true.
If you could afford a car, you could afford to drive.
Yep.
Massachusetts was the first state to require a license and exam in 1920, and the last was South Dakota in 1959.
Oh my gosh.
Great job, Pierre. That's the state capital.
Yeah, it is.
And we can thank the advent of automobiles for all the debt we lug around. Payment installment plans were initiated in 1916 by auto manufacturers trying to compete with the most popular car in the U.S., the Ford Model T. By 1925, 75% of new cars were bought on credit. In 1928, new model year vehicles were introduced, encouraging people to upgrade or update their rides. Quote, it was installment sales of automobiles during the 20s that established the purchasing of expensive consumer goods on credit as a middle-class habit and a mainstay of the American economy.
Gee, thanks.
Oh, cool.
It really worked for me.
It's going quite well.
They did sell other things like appliances back in the day on credit.
Like you could go to Sears and get them.
Yeah, sewing machine or whatever.
So is that kind of the first capitalistic trend of, oh, you've got to get the newest version?
I think that was the reason, yeah.
Wow.
And it worked.
And here we are. Yep.
As famous people always tell us on the TV, it pays to discover. Don't leave home without it. The power of us. It's everywhere you want to be. Take control of your city. It all begins with you. Time to go mobile. What's in your wallet? Priceless. Two of those slogans are quotes from Bane from The Dark Knight Rises. I'll let you figure out which ones.
I think it's what's in your wallet.
James Eugene Bassett went by the name Gene. He was a 34-year-old Naval Academy graduate working at Annapolis, Maryland in 1928. In 1920, it was reported that he had worked for the Great West Lumber Company of Chicago, graduated from the academy the year before, and was stationed with the Pacific Fleet in Honolulu. In 1928, he was again in Maryland, employed as a secretary at a prep school, West Nottingham, in Calora. That July, Gene suddenly resigned from his job and set about to drive from the East Coast to the Puget Sound in Washington. Bassett was set to depart from Washington for the Philippine Islands, having recently gained a position at U.S. Naval Headquarters at Manila Bay, a, quote, secretarial position in the office of a high naval commander.
I don't think I've ever heard of a man being a secretary back then.
His father was a notable secretary for the treasurer of Annapolis or something like that.
Well, women didn't work for quite a long period of time.
So
excellent point.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
And then once, I'm guessing it's probably war that...
Yeah.
But yeah, I think World War II changed
that
forever.
Establish the, you know, women in the workplace.
That's a good point.
Gene was ticketed to depart for the Philippines at 11 a.m. on Saturday, September 8th, on the American Mail Line steamship, the President Cleveland. This was the reason for his resignation from the prep school, and a cross-country auto trip was probably the fastest way to get there. No meandering train ride, no endless interstate bus trip on strung-together highways. Gene Bassett wanted to travel in style, as quickly as the roads would allow, and he purchased a car expressly for the cross-country journey. It was a brand-new, three-tone Chrysler 75 Roadster that had a three-speed manual transmission and a top speed of 70 miles per hour.
Hell yeah.
And that's with it. You're on open road, third gear, you're flooring it, barely getting to 70. The Roadster's slate-blue body was blocky and straight, with a curved back end and a tan fabric convertible top. The front wheel wells looked like deep cobalt waves cresting over its white wall tires. Two large sets of headlights framed the radiator grille. Running boards like a wide ledge span front to rear below the doors, and the spare tires are mounted to the car's side exteriors. There's a luggage rack above the rear chrome bumper, room for two in the vehicle, and two more in the rumble seat, an unsafe cushioned bench that folds down in the back, also called a mother-in-law seat, or what I am calling them, a kill-your-mother-in-law seat. Just open to the wind, too. It's just a chair that you sit in the back.
Love
it's like
it.
Being in the back of a wagon. Let's say Jean Bassett used the Pikes Peak ocean-to-ocean highway, which I talked about a few minutes back. Leaving Maryland, Jean Bassett could have caught the highway in Pittsburgh and driven west all the way to Grand Junction, Colorado. From that point, he could head north through Salt Lake City, then northwest through Boise and the northeast corner of Oregon, along the roads that now make up portions of Interstates 82, 84, and 90, before finally arriving in the Puget Sound area of Washington. I'll guess he could drive 10 hours a day at an average of 25 miles per hour, which feels like a generous estimate.
Oh, my God. Sounds like the worst road trip of a life.
That's 250 miles a day over 3,800 miles or so, which means a bare minimum of 15 days. Gene was rolling solo, road conditions sucked, and he had to sleep sometime. So I'm saying it took him at least 3 grueling weeks to reach the Pacific Northwest.
What is the hotel situation around that time? Did you look into that?
One quote I read said that amenities were few and far between.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, because it took the highway system for motels and stuff to become a thing.
Diners.
So I'm wondering if you could only go to major cities to do that. So you're probably sleeping in your car on the side of the road.
Ugh.
And you got breakdowns constantly.
Emotional ones.
Yeah. Bassett arrived in mid-August and stayed with his sister Emily and brother-in-law Commodore Theodore Winters at the Puget Sound Navy Yard in Bremerton, which is west across the water from Seattle by way of an hour and 15-minute ferry ride. Gene listed his car for sale in Seattle newspapers on August 20th. The ad read, "Chrysler 75 Roadster, 1929 model, only few weeks old. Owner leaving for Orient, $1,600 cash. Phone Navy Yard 331, Bremerton." Gene was first going to have the car shipped to Manila, but his brother-in-law convinced him to sell the Chrysler before he departed and buy a light vehicle in the Philippines. 2 weeks later, on September 4th, a Mr. Clark stopped by the Navy Yard to check out the Roadster. He'd read Bassett's ad in the paper and said the car was perfect, but he first needed his aunt to assess it. She lived in Seattle, so Mr. Clark said, "Why don't you bring the car over on the ferry tomorrow so she can check it out?" If the aunt gave the okay, she would pay Bassett with a certified check for $1,600, the full asking price. So Bassett told Clark, "The Chrysler and I will see you tomorrow." Gene Bassett left the next morning at 9 on a ferry crossing over to the Emerald City. Upon his departure, he told his brother-in-law, Theodore Winters, that he would return by 6 p.m. That evening around 6, Bassett's sister, Emily, received a telegram in Gene Bassett's name. The note detailed that Bassett had run into a friend on his way to Seattle and would take a trip to Vancouver, B.C. and return on Friday the 8th. This struck her as out of character for Gene, and further, he had no friends on the West Coast and had nothing packed for any kind of weekend trip. The next day, the 6th, Commodore Winters confirmed with Canadian authorities at the border that Gene Bassett's automobile had not crossed their paths. The steamship Gene was supposed to catch on September 8th came and went without him embarking. Commander Winters, quote, "personally searched the steamship before it sailed and requested the captain again search for Bassett during a stopover in Victoria, B.C., but he wasn't aboard." The following day, Commodore Winters went to police headquarters in Seattle and convinced Chief of Detectives Charles Tennant that Gene Bassett was missing and likely murdered, which soon kicked off one of the largest and longest body hunts in the history of Washington. Chief Tennant contacted the Maryland DMV to get a detailed description of Bassett's car and its license plate. He then called the DMV in Olympia, Washington, learning that on September 6th, the day after Gene Bassett vanished, a man had used a bill of sale to transfer the Chrysler's title into the name DeCasto E. Mayer and purchase Washington plates. Witnesses said Mayer was in the company of a woman he introduced as his mother.
I don't want to be presumptuous here, but I feel like that earns a good detective bell, especially for back then, that they didn't go, he's a grown man. We caught an earlier ship and he's off to his dream job. Leave us alone.
Didn't have any friends. So
that's true.
I think it helped, too, that the brother-in-law was a Navy man.
I don't think it would have had the same treatment if he wasn't.
Yeah, I forgot that aspect.
Also, Gene Bassett was a Navy person, too.
Oh,
he was
okay.
Still in the military, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I don't know if he was a civilian.
Well,
or if
but
he had
had connections.
So he could maybe get it going that way.
Well, that makes sense.
Thank you. As news of Gene Bassett's disappearance spread, Chief Tennant received vital information from a Seattle dentist named James P. Clark, who told them DeCasto Mayer and his mother had recently leased his house for $40 a month. The residence, always referred to as the Little Brown House because it had no official address, was located in Richmond Highlands, approximately 10 miles north of Seattle. Detectives moved on the Clark rental house, but they were too late. 34-year-old Mayer and his mommy, 62-year-old Mary Eleanor Smith, were already in the wind. Jean Bassett's Maryland license plates were found in the search of the Little Brown House. Investigators found blood spots on the home's interior walls, and a fruitless search for Jean Bassett's body began in the woods surrounding the home. Mayer and Smith's landlord, James Clark, was the origin of the Mr. Clark alias Mayer used in his contacts with Jean Bassett. Which seems stupid. It ties you to...
Like he used his name as an alias?
He used his landlord's name as the alias.
Like that would easily connect you.
Yeah.
Narrow it right down.
On Wednesday, September 12th, a nationwide alert was issued for the seizure of Bassett's three-tone roadster and that its occupants be arrested on a murder charge.
Wow. That's bold.
On September 13th, in Oakland, California, a motorcycle officer stopped a male in his 30s and an older woman driving a blue 1929 Chrysler Roadster, the same as Bassett's. It was confirmed the car's Washington plates matched the ones DeCasto Mayer purchased at the DMV on the 6th. The officer stepped onto the car's passenger side running board and directed the man to police headquarters.
If I killed someone, I'm not sure I'm going to go register the car I stole from them.
The whole idea was new.
Like, just don't register it.
They're like, all right, we killed this guy and got his car. We better go register it. We wouldn't want to get in trouble.
We don't want to break the law here.
On the way, the driver sped among traffic, rear-ended a car, and sideswiped another to knock the officer from the roadster.
Oh, my God. If I could see that, that would have been amazing.
Like old school Grand Theft
Auto. How on earth was that protocol? Was that to keep him from causing a high-speed chase or something? I'm going to stand
probably
on the outside of your car?
Yeah, I think it was probably a standard procedure,
that
I would think.
Wild.
Yeah. The officer, Henry M. Carmina, pulled his firearm and told the driver there'd be no more ruckus. And the rest of their trip to the station was smooth.
Well, listen here,
no more
ruckus.
There'll be no more ruckus.
Pull over, no more ruckus.
I would love to see a motorcycle cop, too, in 1928.
Oh, my God, they're probably badass.
So cool. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure no helmets.
I picture, like, riding boots and, like, the pants that stick out on the side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In custody, the male was ID'd as 34-year-old DeCasto Earl Mayer, who easily admitted to police he'd spent time in prison and employed at least a dozen aliases, like C.C. Skidmore, Tony Montague, D.C. Martin, and D.E. Montaigne.
You know, names that just blend into a crowd.
Very normal sounding.
I'm loving
this
episode.
Hello, I'm Dwayne Fontana.
Jackie Daytona, human bartender.
That's right.
DeCasto Mayer was born in New York in February 1894. His mother, Mary Smith, the passenger in the stolen Chrysler, was born in Pennsylvania, and his father, John M., was a tannery worker who'd emigrated from Germany to the U.S. in 1888. According to the Bridger Times, Mary Eleanor Smith got her son into criminality by having him cash bad checks. He was arrested, sentenced to 9 years in the Montana State Prison, and paroled in only 3. Quote, in time, Mayer became a burglar and motor thief. He has been arrested, sentenced, and paroled a dizzying number of times. On each arrest, with a loyalty worthy of a better cause, he has taken all the blame. On April 11th, 1921, a charge of possessing stolen property against Mayer was dismissed under a writ of habeas corpus. As he left the courtroom, he was arrested by federal agents on auto theft charges and extradited to Utah. On May 16th, those charges were dismissed by U.S. Commissioner Van Etten, and we'll get into the reasons behind this decision in part 2. October 4th, 1921, Mayer, using his C.C. Skidmore alias, was arrested in Pocatello, Idaho, for receiving stolen property. As he was led to the station, he broke away from his police escorts and ran for a nearby train yard. Pursued by the officers, Mayer was shot in the arm as he escaped, and was rearrested several hours later after police found him hiding and bleeding underneath the car he stole, which was stored in an alley garage. His wounds were treated at the hospital, and he was taken to jail. Mayer was also charged with bootlegging. In November 1921, facing further federal auto theft charges in Utah, DeCastro Mayer pleaded guilty, receiving a sentence of up to 10 years. He received nothing for this plea deal, aside from waylaying extradition to Montana, where he would face a far more serious charge, which again, we'll get into in part two. Mayer was soon to be paroled from the penitentiary in Utah in early 1923, and when they let him out of the jug in April, federal agents scooped him right up. In Butte, Montana, Mayer was facing a parole violation for leaving the state, as well as another interstate stolen vehicle charge. He was brought to Helena, Montana to face the charges, receiving only a $25 fine. His parole remained intact, he was released, and soon left the state. In June 1923, Mayer was arrested, charged with burglary in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and given a sentence of 1 to 3 years in the Colorado State Penitentiary. He'd moved to the state only a few days before he was busted, with his initial plan to set up a new spot in which he could store and alter the serial numbers of stolen cars. Mayer got himself arrested after having his 14-year-old brother-in-law pass a forged check. Mayer was paroled on October 30, 1924 from the Colorado prison. Right after his release, he was rearrested at the request of the Pocatello, Idaho Sheriff's Department on a grand larceny charge for stealing a gasoline engine 2 years before and held at the county jail in Canyon City, Colorado. Knowing he would soon be moved to Idaho, the governor there had just signed the extradition papers and the sheriff's department was on its way to collect him, he and three other prisoners celebrated Halloween by escaping from jail. Newspapers said they sawed through the cell's window bars. Witnesses who spied the escapees climbing down a building with tied-together bedsheets thought it was a Halloween prank, so the jailbreak remained unnoticed for several hours. That's a good trick and a great boogity for the guard that found that they were gone.
Also, wouldn't that have taken more than a minute or two and a little bit noisy to...
Probably a couple weeks.
You know?
Months later, in January of 1925, DeCastro Mayer was, quote, apprehended in Kansas and was returned to Canyon City, Colorado. Upon the arrival of Skidmore and Pocatello Friday night, he was taken to the county jail and searched, and a 6-inch saw, among several other filing blades, were found sewed in the lining of his coat sleeves. In March of 1926, Mayer was in Salt Lake City, transferred there to answer for white slavery charges under the Mann Act,
whoa,
which made federally illegal the, quote, interstate transportation of women or girls for prostitution or debauchery.
Oh, so original trafficking. Human trafficking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also that the term white slavery is racist as well.
Yeah.
Because it implies that there is there are other types of slavery.
Yeah.
And that the whites are on top. So Mayer was under the alias D.E. Montaigne when he violated the Mann Act. He was found guilty of, quote, taking Miss Marie Popovich from Texas Creek, Colorado to Helper, Utah. Mayer spent a little more than 2 years in the penitentiary at Leavenworth, Kansas, and incurred a $1,000 fine as a result of these violations. Mayer's accomplice, Mary Popovich of Butte, Montana, was charged with conspiracy to violate the Mann Act. By this point, Mayer had spent 12 and a half years of his life incarcerated. He was, quote, released on parole from Leavenworth on July 31, 1928, and apparently came directly to Seattle to hook up with Mary Smith, his mother, and resume their criminal activities. That's a quote from HistoryLink, and it's not exactly accurate. Before making his way to the Pacific Northwest to join his mother, he first traveled back to Helper, Utah, where he unburied $2,000 he had stashed in a hole.
Whoa. Ooh. That's some real Shawshank shit.
He does a lot of crimes. Mary Eleanor Smith had several known aliases and was known as Shoebox Annie in Utah and Montana.
Why? Why?
These were prohibition times, after all, and she earned the moniker as a bootlegger known to conceal and sell illegal booze hidden inside, you guessed it,
a shoebox.
DeCastro Mayer took after his mother by also getting into the bootlegging business. Known to be an expert mechanic and wheelman, Mayer would boost cars and load them with illicit alcohol for a sweet crime combo. He would then make a run out of state and fill his pockets pawning off the ride as well as the hooch at depots that traded in stolen cars. It was believed Mayer had stolen 300 cars during his criminal career.
That's a lot of cars.
And cars were new. He hasn't had a lot of time. You know, it's not like I did it over 50 years.
Yeah.
It's been a few. Speaking of monikers like Shoebox Annie, A 1948 Pittsburgh Press article reported on a list of the FBI's most distinctive criminal nicknames. They are hilarious, and here are a lot of them.
That sounds fun.
Belching Blanche, Ironfoot Florence, Aggravating Papa, Barbershop Fats, Blue Baby, Hospital Charlie, National Park Mary, Neck, Airbrake Smith, Anteater, Cry and Shame, International Slim, Butcher Knife Liz, Get Back Sally, Rooster Face Fanny, Charlie Kick the Door In, Am I Blue, Bad Eggs, Andy Gump, Apple, Dirty Neck Mabel, Bendem, Big Hog, Iodine, Ammunition Shorty, Accessory Mike, Cool Breeze Cupid, Babbling Bess, Lemonhead, Sixth Street Dirty Red,
Ooh.
Cockeyed Annie, The Mink, Broadway Melody, Slot Machine Betty, Pretty Little Thing, and my absolute favorite, Lots of Mama.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to have to go with Neck.
Oh,
or
it was,
Dirty Neck.
The article said that the agents were fascinated by the person named Neck. It was a lady, and I think it might have implied some sort of sex.
Oh, like she was necking?
Like throat?
I think throat.
Oh,
yeah.
Even throat better.
Yeah.
Even better.
90% of those sounded like horse races.
Among many incriminating pieces of evidence inventoried from the stolen vehicle of Jean Bassett, one item stood out among the rest, a poison gas pistol. Smaller than an already small 32 caliber pistol, like James Bond's little gun or Leo's in The Departed, and constructed of steel-lined rubber, its size belied the damage it could inflict. One cartridge blasted into the face would render a person unconscious and most likely kill them. Police said, quote, "With the gun, enough gas can be injected into a room through the keyhole of the door to stifle or kill all the occupants of the room before they can become aware of its deadly potentialities."
Oh, dear.
Authorities also found a box of 100 cartridges for the gas gun, with 3 rounds missing. D.E. Mayer said Mary Smith had used them to see how the weapon functioned.
Where do you buy one of those?
I have no idea.
Just casually buying that?
Well, the police said it was the first time it had been confiscated in California and perhaps in the entire country.
Wow.
Poison pistols were a recent innovation from combat during World War I.
Oh.
So they were able to turn that into a gun.
Do you think you could still get your hands on those?
I think they still sell gas pistols, yeah.
Wow.
But not, I don't think like that. I think it's, well, it's not meant to kill, I don't think anymore. Quote, "Among their commingled possessions, detectives found Jean Bassett's wallet containing his driver's license and vehicle registration, a belt with souvenir buckle from Yellowstone National Park, and a pair of cufflinks, all identified as belonging to the victim. A search of the vehicle revealed a silver wristwatch engraved with Bassett's name and stuffed between the front seat cushions. It was fully wound and the time correctly set," which means they couldn't have played that they were ignorant that it was there.
Right, because
right.
It was
continually
managed,
wind your
right.
watch. The Blue Roadster also contained a rifle and silencer, chloroform,
oh dear.
And a pair of 4-foot-long tongs suitable for breaking bones.
Jesus.
I don't know what those things looked like or how they were employed.
What? That's crazy.
But I guess you could grab a limb and maybe use leverage. You know, you're grabbing it with both sides with the tong and you can do that.
But what would you need to do that? That is horrific.
Yeah, I don't
Get
know.
Me the bone breaking tongs, Ma.
That's probably a nickname, Bone Breaker Betty.
Oh, my God.
It might be mentioned in part 2, but it was found also that these tongs were not a retail item. They had them custom made
by some, let's think of another nickname, Iron Claw Claude.
Blacksmith Bobby?
Blacksmith Bobby. Blacksmith yeah. Dirtbag Bobby.
Isn't that weird? I think there will be a detail in part 2 also about a giant copper vat that they had commissioned.
Oh, God, I'm scared.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound fun at all.
This is really taking a turn from being
a fun nickname episode.
That's right.
Car thief spree to
something horrific.
Shit out of 7.
Yeah.
Let me get my custom weapon.
On September 18th, it was reported that D.E. Mayer was housed alone on the 13th floor of Oakland City Hall, which, fun fact, according to Wikipedia, was the, quote, first high-rise government building in the United States, also the tallest building west of the Mississippi River when it was built in 1914. Mayer was there until officers from Seattle arrived to bring him back to Washington. the constant solitude made Mayer anxious. When he mentioned it to his jailer, the guard responded with silence. At 5 p.m. Saturday, September 22nd, Mayer and Smith, escorted by Captain Kent, Deputy Prosecutor Dunn, left San Francisco aboard the Pacific Steamship Company vessel Admiral Evans en route to Seattle. Also on board the ship as evidence was Bassett's 1929 Chrysler 75 Roadster. The ship arrived in Seattle at the Pacific Steamship Company docks at 8:45 p.m. on Tuesday, September 25th, and the prisoners were taken directly to the Seattle City Jail and placed in solitary confinement. As an added precaution to keep the pair in custody, a federal grand jury in Seattle indicted Mayer and Smith for violation of the Dyer Act, the interstate transportation of a stolen vehicle. The widening search for Jean Bassett was reported on October 8th, as the sheriff's department scoured locations as far away as Boston Harbor and Tenino, around 65 and 75 miles southwest, respectively, of Seattle. On November 1st, the search for Jean Bassett took a brief turn toward the supernatural. Mm-hmm. That day, a team led by Harbor Patrol diver Joe Barrett dragged the depths of Lake Bollinger, 13 miles north of Seattle, for any trace of the missing man. Barrett told the United Press he was mid-search in the lake when he, quote, was attacked by submarine creatures of more than 3 feet in length. The creatures, Barrett said, looked like a cross between seals and lizards. He attempted to strike at them with a pole, but it was unwieldy. The creatures gathered, darting back and forth and snapping at his rubber suit. Barrett plans to carry a large knife with him when he continues the search tomorrow. Deputy Sheriff Harry Weller was on the site with the search crew, and as Barrett struggled with the lake monsters underwater, Weller fired at the creatures when they surfaced above the diver, but the shots were ineffective. The Seattle Star reported, quote, residents along the shore have made numerous attempts to trap them, but they will not take anything but live fish.
Wait, so there were other people that claimed to have seen them as well?
Yes.
Whoa.
No further monster attacks were reported. And after a tiny amount of research, I think I've found the culprits behind the attack on Joe Barrett. Giant Pacific salamanders.
Oh, yeah. That would make sense. Did they know what those were back then? Probably not. When were they discovered?
Yeah, that's... Hey, man. Whoa.
Let me ask my dad. I'm going to phone home.
Oh, yeah, do that.
My dad would know.
According to animaldiversity.org, these animals are known to be aggressive against any possible predators and those of their own kind. They bite, thrash the tail, try to look formidable, and use glands on the top of the tail to secrete foul-tasting chemicals. In an experiment, they were shown to grab anything attached to a hook and refuse to let go of it, even when dragged from the water. If an adult is chased, it will flee. If captured, it will growl, one of the only salamanders to vocalize, and bite with powerful jaws.
And how big do they get?
These are not the 3-foot behemoths the diver grappled with. These salamanders only grow to 13 and a half inches from snout to tail tip. But there may have been larger species living in the region 100 years ago. Other nicknames for giant salamanders are devil dog, water dog, grampus, mud devil, Allegheny alligator, Lavarian water newt, Ozark hellbender, lasagna lizard, and snot otter.
Oddly enough, I call Alicia Mud Monster.
It's true. Goes way back. Long story.
And the Ozark hellbender
is,
I think, the largest salamander maybe in the States. And I think they're just down in the South, maybe in Arkansas. So the Ozark hellbender can get to be 3+ feet. And it's a little flat,
wet looking
thing.
That would be frightening if you'd never seen one before.
And I guess he hadn't. I don't know. That seems weird.
And I
all
like
of it's
a diver,
so weird.
Don't you think?
And I like the salamander names because it sounds like they are all criminals, too.
Yeah, this is the FBI's list of salamander nicknames.
They're all wanted.
Shit, we got an Ozark hellbender over here.
Ew. Oh, God, that's frightening.
Yeah. Think about it. I mean, even if they weren't 3 feet long, like he said, even a regular giant salamander would be.
Some of them are huge, the size of dogs.
Yep. Snot dogs. Diver Joe Barrett probably disturbed a habitat by moving rocks and kicking up silt during the search, and the snot otters snapped at him in defense. I also found several duplicate articles about salamanders from 1933 and 1937, which read, quote, America's largest salamander, the hellbender, reaches a length of 2 feet and is good to eat.
What? Why would you eat something that looked like that?
There might be a correlation between their current endangered species status and all the hearty encouragement to chew on them. If you have any hot gossip or facts about giant salamanders, please message us at Murder in the Rain. This has been Salamander Central.
I will say that's the kind of fan mail I want to get, honestly.
Salamander Central.
Yeah, I want to know more. I'm going to be Googling this all night.
Back to DeCasto Mayor and Mary Smith, arrested in Oakland driving Gene Bassett's Roadster, in possession of many of his belongings, and suspected of his murder. The pair was extradited to Washington to face charges of grand larceny. Murder charges could not be laid because there was no proof Gene Bassett was dead. Their trial began on December 5, 1928. Previous to that, Mayer and Smith lost legal representation twice. One declined their request flat out, and the other said, "Sorry, I can't because I have to take a trip to California right now." Their replacement lawyer was Henry Clay Agnew, who scored a small victory for the defense, getting the trial date set as early as possible, thinking his clients could outrun murder charges and he could get the W, since the prosecution would have to settle for a larceny conviction. The prosecution was headed by King County's Ewing D. Colvin, who laid out a strong opening statement, relaying DeCasto Mayer and Mary Smith's litany of crimes, their use of many aliases, that Mayer had escaped jail, and most damningly, that the pair had been arrested in Gene Bassett's car, which Mayer had transferred to his name with a forged bill of sale that was entered into evidence. On December 6th, Gene Bassett's sister, Emily Winters, was called as one of the state's first witnesses. She was asked to identify the wristwatch, belt, cufflinks, and wallet found with Mayer and Smith at their arrest, and believed to belong to Gene Bassett. The notary public who'd stamped the bill of sale testified that Mayer, under the name Clark, and Gene Bassett had been in his office on the day Bassett disappeared. On Tuesday the 11th, Inspector J.A. Goodnight of the Oakland Police Department was called to corroborate the defendant's statements after their arrest, and reporter Paul Gray testified that DeCasto Mayer told him that he was the one who forged the bill of sale for the Chrysler. The next day, multiple handwriting experts confirmed that the telegram sent to Bassett's sister in Bremerton on the day he vanished was a forgery and that the writing matched Mayer's. The telegram read, quote, "I have sold my car, met a friend, am going to Vancouver for a couple of days. Will return Friday. Signed, Gene." Gene Bassett's mother, Marion, testified on December 12th that the cufflinks and wristwatch found with Mayer and Smith belonged to her son. She said he never took off the watch unless he was going to bed. Called the case's most dramatic moment by the Seattle Star was the testimony of defense witness W.W. Womer, a grocer with a store near the little brown house Mayer and Smith were leasing north of Seattle. Womer testified that on the day of Bassett's disappearance, he dropped by the house to deliver a pound of butter Mary Smith purchased that morning. He said he was there before noon, and in the driveway noticed a three-tone Chrysler Roadster, later confirmed to be Bassett's. This testimony nailed Mayer and Smith, audibly shocking the court as the grocer recalled the encounter. Yes, a defense witness brought them down.
Wow. I wish I would have been in that courtroom to hear the gasp.
Oh, yeah.
When the grocer changed sides.
People just fainting.
Yes. Ugh. Fanning themselves with newspapers.
And hankies. Closing statements were given. The defense rested without calling Mayer or Smith to the stand. And Judge William J. Steinert turned it over to the jury on Friday, December 14th, 1928. The all-male jurors' deliberations began at 4:30 that afternoon. It was going to be a long weekend. The group re-examined each piece of evidence and line of testimony, pored through documents, and cross-checked the alleged timeline again and again. Just kidding. They came back with guilty verdicts in less than 4 hours, which included a one-hour lunch break.
God, I wish I was on a jury.
Defense attorney Agnew pleaded for the release of Mary Smith after the verdict was delivered, and became hoarse as he spoke. Gene Bassett's mother gave him a cough drop so he could go on. DeCasto Mayer was later sentenced to life in prison as a habitual criminal.
Wait, was that actually the charge?
Yeah, it was a weird law that they had back in. I think it was, well, I don't know if it was just in Washington, but Washington had that law.
Just like, we've given you so many chances and you just clearly suck, so we're done with this.
And he'd been in at least 6 prisons.
I like that.
He was committed to the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla on February 15th, 1929. Mary Smith received an 8.5-year sentence and was also sent to the prison in Walla Walla. And another quote from HistoryLink. In 1931, Robert M. Burgunder replaced Colvin as King County prosecutor. Admitting there was virtually no hope of finding Bassett's body, Burgunder withdrew the watch, wallet, belt, and cufflinks from the exhibits filed with the Superior Court and sent them to Gene Bassett's parents, Frank P. and Marion F. Bassett in Annapolis, Maryland, as keepsakes.
That was nice.
The Roadster was also turned over to his parents, who sold it in Seattle at a Chrysler dealership. Though the assumed culprits behind Gene Bassett's likely murder were incarcerated, the search for his remains continued. In late November 1929, a group of searchers, called a posse in newspapers, spent a night checking graves in a Bothell, Washington cemetery as a, quote, cold-looking moon came up over the East Hills and the tombstones cast long shadows the length of the graves. The posse cracked open many coffins that night, none of which contained Bassett's corpse. April 16, 1930, a fully clothed skeleton wearing a dark top coat was found in a ravine near Seattle's Lake Union by three boys playing there. Its skull held one gold tooth. It was not Gene Bassett. 6 months later, hopes that Gene Bassett's skeletal remains had been found in Des Moines, Washington, 18 miles south of Seattle, were dashed when it was determined the bones found on the property of resident George Jackson had been there nearly 10 years. The skeleton could not be identified. March of 1931 brought news from Oakland, California, the site of Mayer and Smith's arrest, of the discovery of yet another skeleton that turned out not to be Bassett's. This one was also found by kids who stumbled upon it while playing. April 16, 1931, a skull found in Seattle's Seward Park neighborhood on Lake Washington was determined not to be Bassett's. It was thought to be connected to an unsolved murder in June 1928, in which a torso missing its head was discovered in a deep gully near Newport, Washington, on the Idaho border. July 1931, a burlap sack weighed down with rocks and containing most of a human skeleton was found by a fisherman in Edmonds, Washington, in the Puget Sound just north of Seattle. Only the collarbones and skull were missing. It turned out the bones had been removed from a shallow grave in an old cemetery by three boys who unburied the skeleton while out gathering wood. A few weeks later, they pitched the sack with the bones into Puget Sound rather than rebury them, which is so cool to do.
Boys being boys.
Mm-hmm. In March of 1932, a road crew shoveling gravel on Maple Street in Snohomish, northeast of Seattle, uncovered a badly decomposed skeleton. The puzzle of its identity was solved by a, quote, pioneer citizen and resident named Arthur Preston, who remembered that as a child in 1885, his father had unearthed several skeletons, which he turned over to Old Doctor, an indigenous man who lived on a nearby ranchery. Old Doctor delivered the bones for reburial to Priest Point on the southernmost tip of the Tulalip Reservation, 40 miles north of Seattle. The land where the pioneer boy's father uncovered the skeletons had once been, according to Arthur Preston, an, quote, Indian cemetery. In December 1933, a report of a skeleton found near Bellevue, Washington, brought to the minds of the sheriff's office Gene Bassett, now missing more than 5 years. Deputies and reporters rushed to the freshly uncovered skeleton they quickly determined was not human, a conclusion they reached when one of them said, those are goat horns. Other than intermittent searches for Gene Bassett's body, the case went stagnant, seeming that it would provide no resolution or peace for those who knew the man. That was until May of 1938. Mary Eleanor Smith, the mother of DeCasto Mayer, who'd been incarcerated at the Washington State Penitentiary alongside her son, chose in the last few days of her term to write a confession detailing the ensnarement, coercion, murder, dismemberment, and disposal of Gene Bassett. And that is where we will begin next week in part two.
She waited till her sentence was almost done?
Yeah.
She couldn't have found that conscience at the beginning and taken a plea deal and get these families answers?
No.
Oh, okay.
How dare you
classic,
even ask?
Wait, is this Shoebox?
Shoebox Annie.
Classic Shoebox.
To compound butters, what's that? Marinades and reductions.
Why did you say what's that about the?
Because I don't know what compound butter is.
Whatever those
what's
are.
What's that?
I don't know what any of that is, but it sounds delicious.
Rather than have it shipped to him, it... Fudge.
Remember our road trip, Em?
I certainly do, and there was beef jerky on
that. I was
going to
say, I think that's part of the beef jerky
beef
problem.
Beef jerky, we had chicken
buffalo wings.
We had rolls from Winco, like a big thing of rolls. That was the weirdest snack that we bought.
Just like yeast rolls?
Yes, just like dinner rolls. And guess what? We ate them all.
Oh, yeah.
They don't even have patellas, for cripe's sake.
Oh, my boy.
Oh, my boy.
Emily would love to bend over.
I'm
going to
take
you.
Out a turd.
Oh, my boy. Oh, my boy.
In 1920. Oh.
Oh, my boy.
Honolulu is one of the best words.
Honolulu, and it means protected bay.
It does mean protected bay.
For when Colin Jost calls us to be on Jeopardy.
That's right. And they can tell him their celebrity name, he and his wife, Scarlin Jojo.
Boy.
You don't like that?
Really,
Scarlett Johansson,
really
Colin
for
Jost.
Them.
Scarlin Jojo.
I think he's going to appreciate that so much.
He will. He's not heard it. No one said that to him yet. I'm the first guy to think it.
The intellectual property you're most protective of.
Trademark.
Surprised he said it out loud.
Yeah, on a recording.
Well, I want someone to hear it besides Leash. She's the only person I talk to, except the void.
Until well, you'll you say be, it again, I'll be like,
yeah,
that
you'll
sounds
be so,
familiar.
You'll think it's hilarious when I say it in front of Mr. Jost.
Oh, when boy. We're on the show, which will happen.
Spouse of Jojo. Scarlin Jojo.
Here we go.
You can't waste that tongue energy talking so much goof.
We talk about rotisserie chicken a lot.
I don't got no farts today.
Go to hell for lying, the same as stealing.
Well, duh. You don't tell me, I tell you. I went to Catholic school, mother effer. Received a telegram in Jean Bassett's name.
You said telegram weird.
Telegram?
Telegrama.
Grandma.
Ooh.
Telegrama. Hello? Is this my grandma? You're a bitch.
And dead, you stupid. That's such a sister move. Actually, my brother didn't have any friends, so I do not believe this, and I will investigate.
Thing about the new Teslas, was that in Lake Oswego? Because that's definitely Lake-o
crime
beat.
No.
Lake-o
crime
beat.
Lake-o
crime beat.
No, it wasn't.
All right. Looks like a chips.
Yeah. Oh, I loved that show.
Oh, me too.
Conceal and sell illegal booze. A 1948 Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh into Vicksburg. Well,
You're not on trial, sir.
I am always. When there's a recording going, I'm always on trial with myself. And I'm a brutal prosecutor.
100% conviction rate.
Also, the tallest building west of the Mississippi River.
Let's take that one again.
I lost it. I lost. Yeah.
Mississippi River.
Mississippi River.
Around 65 in the 70. I bit my lip.
And one of my favorite strains.
Ozark Hellbender. Yeah, it'll knock you out.
Is that real?
No, but it's.
Oh, that does sound like one.
Some Alaska thunderfuck.
For those of you who don't know, she means marijuana.
A weed strain.
Do you think it was compound butter?
Watch that. Mother gave him a cough drop so he could continue. I need a cough drop. The entire state of Washington is the backyard pool in Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain. And suck my balls.